Hi, I'm Katrina Daniel, and welcome to Primetime Crime, a podcast for people who want to know what goes on behind the scenes of the most notorious trending crime stories and what's going on in the minds of those involved in those stories. What are the detectives, the judges, the defense attorneys, and the prosecutors thinking? You'll hear it all on Primetime Crime, the podcast. This is Primetime Crime. I'm Katrina Daniel. Okay, now we've all had neighbors we thought were really weird. We may actually have called them crazy. I admit I've had at least a couple, but mine were not serial killing madmen bombers. Jamie Gehring's neighbor was, and you'll recognize his name, that brilliant bearded hermit, Ted Kaczynski, a.k.a. the Unabomber. Over a period of 17 years, Kaczynski mailed or hand-delivered at least 16 homemade bombs, killing 3 people and wounding 23 others. I'm talking to Jamie today. She's just written a book about her off-the-wall, deadly, and weird next-door neighbor in the deep woods of Montana. The book, appropriately titled The Madman in the Woods, it's a true crime memoir, and guaranteed to be a bestseller for those of us with an interest in these things. It is an account of her childhood in really remote Montana, where Ted Kaczynski came over to eat dinner and play cards with her parents. And as she got older, scared her more as she became an aware adult. I mean, can you imagine running into Ted Kaczynski alone in the middle of the woods? Jamie Gehring can. Jamie, thanks for being here.
The arrest of the Unabomber.
It was a story that brought the nation's attention to this small, unassuming cabin in a remote area of Montana.
Why did you do it? Are you the Unabomber?
The Treasure State didn't ask for it, but suddenly all eyes were on Lincoln, Montana. After a 17-year search for the elusive terrorist that became known as the Unabomber, short for University and Airline Bomber, FBI agents finally closed in on their reclusive prey, Ted Kaczynski.
Hey, Jamie, welcome, and thanks for being our guest today. I mean, we've got a bazillion questions for you. Tell me, first of all, what made you decide to write a book about living and sharing a backyard with the Unabomber after all these years?
Good morning. Thank you for having me. Yes. So I have always wanted to write this book. And especially, obviously, after Ted Kaczynski was arrested, I was only 16 years old. And it took some time and some processing to decide what kind of story I wanted to tell. And then my father, who was a large part of the investigation, had passed away. And that kind of pushed me even further to finish this project and to really honor his memory and tell this story. So it was kind of a myriad of things that finally pushed me to share my story with the world.
Explain to us, you were living in the same small town in Montana. And he was your next door neighbor?
Yes. So in 1971, my grandfather, Clifford Gehring Sr., sold Ted and David a small plot of land. And it was about 1.4 acre. And my grandfather had owned about 9,000 acres of ranch land right outside Lincoln, Montana, which is a tiny little town. I mean, currently there's about 1,000 residents, give or take, one small flashing yellow stoplight in town. So that can help you picture it a bit. So Ted and David Kaczynski bought the property in 1971. My father built his cabin with my mother in the late 70s, early 80s. And it was only about just a little under a quarter mile from Ted's property. So for the next 25 years after the purchase, we basically, our family's land surrounded their plot of land there.
What was his behavior like toward you? Because you obviously can't talk about his behavior to anybody else. But how did he treat you guys and your parents?
He was, my parents in those early days really thought he was just, you know, kind of a shy, reserved guy. He seemed very kind. My mother specifically never really feared him. She just thought, you know, he was this strange hermit who decided to live off grid in rural Montana. And they kind of took him for what he appeared on the surface, at least.
So they were very tolerant and probably welcoming.
They were very welcoming. And really through the years, even as Ted got a little, I would say a little more strange, his behavior had changed quite a bit. He became more isolated. My parents would still try to do what they could for him. They would bring him firewood, or they would offer to have him work at the sawmill, things like that, just to kind of help him out.
You say his behavior got strange. I mean, what, you know, like if he came over to your house, how would he act?
His behavior got strange in the way that, for one, his appearance did change over the years. So in the earlier years, he was definitely more of that Berkeley professor that you can imagine, although still disheveled, and clearly he was living off the land. But as the years went on, his appearance was much different, and also the way that he behaved. So he would have, his clothing was completely ripped and torn, and holes in his shoes, dirt under his fingernails, soot on his face. Depending on the time of year, he would look kind of emaciated. And in respect to his behavior, he was definitely seemingly much more task driven. So if he would come by the house, he would want to know what time it was, what day it was. And his behavior was just much, much different than it was in those earlier years.
Were you ever scared of him?
I was scared of him, yes, as I had gotten older. And I say this in the book as well. I'm not sure if it's purely because I was getting older and understanding more of the world around me, or if it was kind of a combination of that and then also Ted's kind of shift as well. I mean, clearly, as the time ticked on, he was more immersed in his reign of domestic terror. So it probably could have been both of those factors. But yeah, there were times where he would come by the home and he would want the time or want to know what day it was, and my parents weren't home, and I would hide in the closet until I knew he was gone. And in later years, you know, pretty close to right before he was arrested, there was a time that I met him in the woods by myself, and I will never forget that feeling of just sheer terror being alone with him in those woods and just knowing that something was off.
Yeah, and you can't put your finger on it. God, you know, in retrospect, did you talk to your parents about it afterwards and how they felt?
It wasn't until really much later that I spoke with my parents about it. And you know, it wasn't exclusive to Ted that he was this person living off grid in this environment. Yeah. Yeah. So there were other people that lived a similar, seemingly similar lifestyle. And so, you know, it wasn't, again, it wasn't alarming that our neighbor was living this way.
Yeah. Yeah. There are a lot of people who just don't want to be bothered out there, and you wouldn't want to look at their motives because it's really none of your business, at least back in the day. Your dad played a role in his capture. Explain that to us and how the FBI approached him and what he provided.
My father did play a role in the investigation and in the capture of the Unabomber. And months before Ted's arrest, FBI agent Max Knoll arrived in Lincoln and was just, you know, kind of surveying the situation, determining who he could trust, who he could work with, and really understanding what he was facing here with attempting to capture who they thought was the Unabomber. And so one of those people that Max decided to interact with was my father, Butch Gehring. And in, you know, their first few meetings, they were still trying to kind of figure each other out, decide if they could trust one another. And Max did tell my dad that they were investigating his neighbor for writing threatening letters. And as they continued to talk, Max really did come to the understanding that he could trust my dad. And he told him the truth that they really suspected Ted of being the Unabomber. And of course, my father was completely shocked. Here's this man who he has, you know, that has lived by our family for 25 years, who lives off the land, off grid. Yes, he's strange, but he's just Teddy. He's just, you know, he lives on like $200 a year. There's no way he could be responsible for this reign of domestic terror. But as time went on, things started to kind of make sense. And he came to an understanding that, yes, it definitely could be Ted. And there were a few things that the FBI had asked him to do specifically through the investigation, which one of them was to record the terrain and the cabin of Ted Kaczynski in preparation for the arrest. And so, you know, my dad knew there were potentially bombs, that this man could be the Unabomber. He knew he had a rifle. He knew how violent and dangerous he was, but he also knew that there was no other choice because anybody else would look out of place. And Ted Kaczynski was methodical and he was looking for outsiders.
How much interaction did Ted Kaczynski have with outsiders on, say, a weekly basis?
Ted Kaczynski had hardly any interaction with outsiders. I mean, he spent his days in that cabin and in the forest around it, in, you know, our shared backyard for years and years. He would come into town occasionally. And when I say town, I'm talking about Lincoln, Montana, approximately 4 miles from his cabin. He would walk into town or ride his bike to get supplies or go to the library. And, you know, there were a few people in town that he would talk with, but for the most part, he was completely alone.
Do you find that sad in retrospect?
I do. I find it sad, but clearly it was a choice. And yeah. I do think that it probably contributed to his madness being isolated for so long. But that's the way his life had to look in order to do what he did.
Do you think your family was ever at risk from him?
Our family was definitely at risk from him. I mean, while I wrote my book, I did discover many different things that I hadn't known about or known the full story on until doing my research and interviews. So there were different occasions. There was a time in which Ted had seen my stepmother and my little sister, who was 2 at the time, in the woods and was looking at them through his rifle scope and really contemplating if he was going to kill them. And I think that was definitely the most difficult thing to write about. And then there were other discoveries as well, such as after the arrest, there was neck height wire found around our property. And Ted, then I also found journal entries that Ted was placing those in order to harm people on a motorized vehicle. So, and I was one of those people. I had a little Honda 90 motorcycle that I would ride around our logging roads and property through the years. And that was definitely difficult to process, knowing as an adult really what harm that could have done.
In other words, he was stringing wire between trees and stuff so you would be decapitated as you rode by?
Yes, exactly.
Holy mackerel. How did you find this out? You were reading his journals, the things that he left behind?
Yeah, so the way I found out most of the things throughout the book, in addition to my own experiences, were one, sitting down with FBI agent Max Knoll, who was the arresting officer on the Unabom case, and then also reading through Ted's journals. And when I say journals, they're notebooks that were found in the cabin, really with recordings of Ted's innermost thoughts. So it ranged from what he ate that day, what he hunted, what he was reading, to then his criminal activity as well. And I do reference some of those in my book. So, the reader is along for the ride, really discovering what I was discovering while writing the book.
Do you think you dodged a huge bullet or a bomb in this case?
I think we were very lucky that we only experienced some sabotage, some close calls. My dog was poisoned and did die. From Kaczynski. So there were definitely some tragic things that happened. But yes, of course, when you look at what he did on a national scale, absolutely.
Mm. The dog alone would cause me to kill him. Sorry, Ted, you're done. Have you been in contact with him? I see that you may have written him, since he's got like, what, 8 life sentences?
Exactly. Yes, he does. And he was in the Supermax in Florence, Colorado. And yes, I did write to him. In addition to wanting to write this book, I have always wanted to write him a letter as well and really just express how shocking that was, that he fooled us for so long. And I don't know, it's probably just part of my own personal need for closure, I suppose. Good so point. In writing the book, I decided to finally write the letter. And I was also kind of searching for that kernel of good still. I mean, he'd been in prison for some time. So I thought maybe there's a chance that he's had time to reflect and change, and he can really clarify his motive. And so anyway, that's what I was kind of looking for. So yes, I did write to him. But then since that, he was moved to Butner FNC. Lord.
He's in North Carolina now.
Yes, he is.
Very interesting. So he's in a less maximum security. I wonder why they took him out. Do you have any idea?
Well, a lot of times when people are transferred there, it's due to health reasons.
Awesome.
And he is aging. So yes, I believe there are some health issues going on.
What did you say to him in your letter? How did you address it? Did you say, Ted, do you remember me, Mr. Kaczynski? How'd you address it?
So in my letter to Ted, I did start out with, you may remember me as the little girl next door. And, I'm even told that you helped me as a baby. He was very, he knew who we were. I mean, we lived right next door to him. So even just my last name, I didn't really need to explain too much. But I went on from, my initial intro to telling him of my father's passing. And of course, they didn't always see eye to eye, but there's a certain camaraderie that was definitely felt between them for so long. So I shared that news. And, I just went through some history, honestly, since his arrest. And when he did write back, there was no mention of the personal things that I had spoken of. It was all on the surface. It was, and that wasn't surprising because that's how it was my whole life with him. If there was a personal question asked by one of my parents, he would quickly deflect and give like a very, very surface answer. And so it is what I expected.
Okay. Do you think he holds a grudge against your family or your dad, which is too late now, fortunately?
Yeah, it's too late now. I mean, I I don't think so, because even with the FBI agents that arrested him, he has been very respectful and almost like understanding of it all. I mean,
really?
Yes. I mean, he, and I do, I write about that in the book, like when Kaczynski was taken in, the last words he said to the agents that arrested him was, "Thank you for the good treatment." So I think Ted knows that, you know, he was committing crimes and,
well, yeah,
I mean, and eventually that had to come to an end. I don't honestly think that he holds a grudge towards the people that that put an end to that, other than, of course, his own brother, because,
yeah,
you know, that's, that dynamic is obviously just a bit different.
Did he ever reveal a motive? It's been hard to find. He took people at random. He, what, killed three, injured, what, 23 or so others. Did he ever, why did he pick on these people?
So that is a question that I was really trying to answer in the book as well, because yes, his victims seem to be very indiscriminate. They range from university students, yep, to professors, to geneticists, to, yes, a computer store owner, airplane. Yep. I mean, yes, they're all over the place. So in searching, that's what I was really looking for, because, you know, Ted Kaczynski rails against technology in the Industrial Revolution. And so you kind of assume that that has to be the motive, right? And of course, that's part of it. But in his journal entries, he says his motivation is purely revenge.
For what?
Well, that's the question, right? Exactly. For what? And, you know, it's hard to say, because you can't say exactly what is in Ted Kaczynski's mind and what is creating that. But I think it's a combination of, you know, experiences through his life and how he feels towards society and others, and being able to form relationships and, you know, just live in within society as a normal functional person. And so I think it's just a variety of experiences for him that have created this complete hatred towards tech, towards society.
Yeah, that and 167 IQ, which, again, I guess that would make you kind of strange, you know, because you'd be so much more aware of things that the rest of us with much lesser IQs probably aren't. Anything else that you think is really important that people should know?
Other things that I think people should know and understand, you know, many people have asked, like, do you think that your book is too sympathetic, or, you know, how can you explain kind of those softer feelings towards Ted as a kid? And because I was a kid, I was a kid. And as a kid, we trust the people around, yes, us, and, yes, we look at people through a different lens. And I think that's important. And I still think it's important as an adult looking back. Of course, the experiences that Ted had do not excuse his violence in any way.
Right.
But right. It was important for me specifically to look at this person's story and really try to understand what created him as much as we possibly can understand that. And, you know, those things where he was separated from his mother at 9 months old and put in the hospital at the height of these developmental milestones, and especially, mm-hmm, separation anxiety. And so, of course, that affected his ability to form close bonds and relationships through the years. I mean, and that's just kind of the first small thing. And then there was other smaller things that happened, you know, through his life, his advancement in school and not being able to really relate to people. And then, of course, some questionable experiments at Harvard. And so there were all these different things in the making of him. And I really think it is important to remember that everybody does have a story, and his story was paired with underlying mental illness. So it's not a shocking revelation when you look at these experiences and, you know, the potential of the underlying mental illness that it created this what we see as a monster.
Yeah. But he's in prison for the rest of his life. Would you ever consider visiting him?
Funny you should ask, because prior to the pandemic, I was exploring that possibility of being placed on his visitation list and going to visit him. And then everything was kind of shut down as far as visitation goes. And then he was moved to Butner. So I don't think that will happen.
Okay. Just curious. It would be really kind of interesting. But then other than curiosity, is really not a reason you would do it unless closure, which kind of is an important thing for many people.
Yeah, I think that writing this book really did provide a lot of closure for me personally. And there's not that deep need now to go visit my former neighbor.
Yeah, I can understand that. Jamie Gehring, this has been the most interesting, fun, which is a weird word for such a topic, discussion, but you've got some really behind the scenes insights to one of the biggest puzzles in America's crime history. Your book, The Madman in the Woods, is a really appropriate title. I wish you every single piece of luck with it.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Primetime Crime, the podcast. Follow us on Facebook at Primetime Crime and on Instagram and Twitter at PrimetimeCrime_. Post your comments and tell us what true crime stories you'd like to hear about. Subscribe to Primetime Crime on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and Google Podcasts. Thanks a lot.